Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Terrence McNally, whose recent musical, A Man of No Importance, is now at the New Conservatory Theater in San Francisco through April 11th. Terrence McNally is the author of several plays, including Love, Valor, Compassion, Lisbon, Traviata, Masterclass. Stendhal Syndrome is in New York right now on Broadway. Also the author of several librettos to successful musicals, including The Rink, Kiss of the Spider Woman, Ragtime, The Full Monty, and now A Man of No Importance. A Man of No Importance played last September at Lincoln Center. Did you ever intend for it to transfer to Broadway, or did you know it would be just a limited run at Lincoln Center?
Well, we did it at Lincoln Center in a very ideal production with a wonderful director cast headed by Roger Rees. It would have been very hard to move it to Broadway because it took place on a thrust stage, and the whole production would have had to have been entirely reconceived to move it to a conventional Broadway space. So we were happy with its 3.5-month run at the Lincoln Center Theater, where the audience almost sits around the actors. It's not quite in the round, but it's about 80 degrees around with audience. Also, it was an intimate musical. It does not rely on star power. And Broadway right now is not as welcoming to smaller shows without big names in it as I would like it to be. So we were very happy to be on that stage in an ideal production.
It seems that in Broadway, the kind of shows that used to get on just aren't making it anymore. And I think you say in, your introduction to one of your plays, that what's happened is that regional theater, even New York regional theater, is becoming the place for plays to be and not Broadway.
Right. Broadway is not as welcoming to the new play as it was when I first moved there. But still, plays get to Broadway every year. It's just great difficulty. And usually they don't come to Broadway until they've been reviewed in California or Seattle or Chicago successfully. People are very, very cautious because of the enormous amount of money it takes to put a play up on Broadway. With the economy being what it is, it's understandable, but I wish that there wasn't such a lemming-like attitude about, oh, it got a good review in London, let's bring it to Broadway. And we import so many British plays, and they do not return the favor. They're not bringing our work over in the same quantity. But, you know, it's a reality of the business, and it changes. I mean, this could all, 10 years from now, Broadway is flooded with new American plays. But right now it's very lean, and I admire the producers who are willing to take a chance on a new play. And I think the playwrights who are the authors of those plays are very, very lucky. My first play was done on Broadway when I was 23 years old, and it was the very first play I'd ever written. It was called In Things That Go Bump in the Night. It was a big flop, so maybe we should have tested it around. But it was my first play, and it was a great experience for me. The play had never been tried out. It wasn't reviewed anywhere. And my youth, I don't think that would happen in the next 10 years. They're going to look around and make sure it's been tested in a few regional theaters first.
Terrence McNally, before we went on the air, you began telling the story of how you discovered A Man of No Importance. I assume that you went to Ahrens and Flaherty rather than they coming to you?
Lynn Ahrens, who writes the lyrics, and Stephen Flaherty, who writes the music, I think are incredibly talented team of songwriters. And when I was asked to work on a musical of Ragtime, they submitted 5 or 6 songs on a tape, unmarked, along with several other composers. It was kind of an audition process. And I said to the producer, the only people who I think have the tone of this book are whoever it is, man, woman, man and woman, whatever, dog, whoever wrote the songs on tape 3. And he opened the envelope and he said, it's by Ahrens and Flaherty. And actually, I had admired their work enormously. A show called Once on This Island, which had been done in New York. We worked on Ragtime. It opened. It was very successful. I think it had a cast of 67 when it opened, or 63. I forget. It's just over 60. It's probably the last of the really big shows. We loved working together, and we wanted to do something else, but we wanted to do something small, intimate, chamber-like, the exact opposite of Ragtime. We did not want to do an epic. So we looked and talked and read. Nothing seemed right. And then one day I was waiting in a video store in line to check out in Chicago, and I saw this movie, $1, you know, you can have it for 3 weeks. And I said, look at that cast, Albert Finney, Brenda Fickett, Michael Gambon, Rufus Sewell, all these good actors. How bad can it be? I'd never heard of it. I put it on, and I just was enchanted by it. I called Lynn and Steve, and I said, I found what I think should be our next project. They rushed to their video stores and found it, and they didn't like it as a music. They didn't like it, and they didn't see it as a musical. So I said, okay, win some, lose some. About 6 months later, we still hadn't found anything we wanted to work on. They were all doing other projects. Life continues. But at any rate, Stephen called and said, you know, I watched that movie again, and I really think maybe there's something there. And then Lynn looked at it again. She said, yeah, me too. And they said, could you write like the first 20 pages to give us an idea how it might translate into a musical? Because it's a movie that takes place on a bus in the streets of Dublin. Film is a very realistic medium. How are we going to find the way to theatricalize this? So I wrote 20 pages or so, and they said, we got it. You know, we can hear music now. Lynn said, I can hear words. Stephen said, I can hear. And then the show wrote itself very, very quickly, within 6 months. We played it for Lincoln Center, and Andre Bishop, who's the artistic director there, said, we want to do this show. And that's what happened. It was a very fun show to write, quick show to write, and he had a wonderful production in New York. It was never a show in trouble. You know, you hear stories about musicals getting 8 new songs and a whole new second act. It never went through anything like that. The real genesis is my desire to work with Lynn and Stephen again on something smaller in scale than Ragtime, which was such an epic show. And we tell the story of Man of No Importance with, I think, 13 actors. Well, I'm sure there's some creative director out there who will find a way to do Ragtime one day with 3 people. But right now... I was happy we had the 60-plus cast on Broadway.
A Man of No Importance, constructing a play is one thing, but there's got to be some kind of difference between constructing a play and a libretto where you know that the songs every so often will further the plot. How do you go about doing that, and how do you go about figuring where those songs will be, or do you figure it, or do they figure that?
Every librettist works differently with his or her collaborators. In this case... The way I like to work, and I've written musicals with Lynn and Stephen, I've written musicals with John Kander and Fred Ebb, and I wrote The Full Monty with David Yazbek. In all of those cases, I wrote a play first called The Full Monty, a play called Kiss of the Spider Woman, and they found the songs in the scenes. Now, when you write a scene that you're going to give to a composer and a lyricist, you kind of overwrite. You leave lots of material for them to musicalize, to inspire them, for lack of a better word. Most people think book writing for a musical, libretto writing, is leaving spaces saying, he sings a song here saying how much he loves her. That's not the way I write musicals. Maybe some people do it that way. I just read a biography of Cole Porter where they would cable him in Paris saying Merman needs another ballad for the second act, and he would write one. Those days, thank God, of books having no relationship to the score are over. But so we work very closely, but first I write a scene. Usually the song comes just about where I thought it was. Sometimes a line of mine will trigger a song or will trigger something exactly the opposite, but it will still trigger it. But then there's some amount of jiggling. Well, we don't need that line now, and you finesse it. The 3 composers I've worked with all use my words and situations as an inspiration for their music and their lyrics. So I think the book does come first, probably in most modern collaborations. I really don't know how another librettist works, because there aren't that many of us around, and we all don't hang out together anyway. So I see them, you know, hi, how you doing? But I don't say, how did you write your book? So somewhere out there on a floppy disk somewhere is a play called Ragtime, a play called, not a play I would want performed, right, mind you, but written in the format, style of a play that I was hoping would speak to Kander and Ebb, Aarons and Flaherty, David Yazbek.
You gave it to them, and then at a certain point they come back to you and say, this is where we want the song to be.
Usually, you know, within a day or so, you know, we read the scene and we think it would be great if she sang a song, and using those images and stuff. I mean, sometimes there's a whole line or several lines of dialogue that end up in the song. I mean, and you have to... You know, that doesn't mean I wrote the lyrics. It means the lyricist used my words to launch a song or get into one. Fred Ebb calls it, who's a lyricist with John Kander, Chicago Cabaret, he calls it cannibalizing the librettist text. And he, in lectures that he gives, he talks about a song in Spider Woman, and he reads the scene I wrote, and then he reads the song, sings the song he and John Kander wrote, and it's Hard to say where one begins and the other leaves off, but I take no credit for the song, don't get me wrong. But I'm happy I provided the fodder for it.
On something like Kiss of the Spider Woman, did you go back to the original novel, or did you work off the movie? Or?
No. In the case of Spider Woman, I saw the movie again. I tried to read the novel. I found it very heavy going, and we sort of made our own version of it because every version of the story is quite different in terms of the story being told and who Aurora is. Puig was very pleased. It was one of the last, just before he died, he saw Spider Woman. He was very happy with what we'd done, but it was quite a departure from his, but still, I think it respected the themes of his book, which, you know, is freedom and depression and how we all have to dream because reality can be incredibly painful, especially if you're in prison being tortured as a political prisoner.
I read on Broadway.com a line from Ken Mandelbaum where he said that the character of Aurora in the musical was written specifically for Cheetah Rivera. Is that true?
No. She was certainly always a candidate for the role, but when we first did the show, she did not create the role in the very first production. But after we did that version, we realized we needed needed someone with a real persona to it. So John and Fred, you could say, I'll write everything for either Liza Minnelli or Cheetah Rivera, but we did not think she was going to be doing the show, and she did.
I was lucky she went on tour, and while Vanessa Williams was in New York, she was out here, and I managed to see her. She was amazing.
Cheetah lifting her leg today is still more exciting to me than someone half her age doing somersaults. I mean, she's got the authority, and she's, you know, worked with every great choreographer of the Broadway theater the second part of the last century, from Jerry Robbins to Michael Bennett to Gower Champion to Bob Fosse. I mean, she's the end of an era. When Cheetah hangs up her shoes, that really will be the end of half a century of musical theater. I mean, she did West Side Story. I think she was still a teenager. I think she was 19 or 20 when she did Anita in West Side Story.
Terrence McNally, when the first version is done, is there a certain point where you kind of go, let's see how an audience responds, and you just put it on? Does that happen at the read-through where you know you're going to be making the changes? What's that process like?
In today's theater, with the costs being so high, and also shows used to travel out of town to get it right before they brought it to Broadway. When I first started working in the theater, you'd see a little story in the New York Times. West Side Story postpones opening 6 weeks. Fiddler on the Roof delays Broadway opening 8 weeks. The internet did not exist, so all these people weren't saying, oh, I hear Fiddler's a disaster. West Side Story's the biggest bomb. It was just something you did to get your show right. One of the reasons the road collapsed is because modern productions are so big. You can't take, it takes 3 or 4 weeks to get the set up on the stage and the everything to work. The old shows, My Fair Lady and those shows, a lot of it was on, you know, canvas, up and down. You could hang the show. And My Fair Lady originally went to New Haven for 4 performances, closed on a Saturday night and opened on Boston on Tuesday. And in today's world, the set of Full Monty took 2 weeks to put up. So, and that was, quote, a small show. So the road died, and now people do workshops, readings to get a response to the audience. But no one puts a show on for an audience thinking, oh, this isn't very good. It's the best we can make it. And then the audience, it still doesn't work for an audience. And that's when we start doing revisions.
Well, I keep wondering when you hear something like what happened with Sondheim's Bounce, mm-hmm. In its earliest Wise Guys. They do a reading of it, and suddenly the word filters. Everyone hated it. Even before they do the reading, I mean, wouldn't, say, Sondheim and Weidman or Lapine or whoever was involved with it, wouldn't they have some idea that something didn't work? Or would they have to have those people do it at that point?
That's a very complicated question. Sometimes shows are, by contract, just the ball has been set in motion and there's no turning back. A show by Stephen Sondheim probably gets announced and the Kennedy Center says, oh, we'll do it for 8 weeks. And the Goodman Theater said, we'll do it for 6 weeks. And no matter how badly the workshop may have gone, I'm sure everyone felt, gee, that's 14 weeks of performance, rehearsal time. Maybe we can fix it. No one willingly goes ahead and has a bad experience in the theater. It's a mystery what turns out. There's famous stories of shows that did not work, that with the addition of one song. I've had that experience in my life, a play of mine I wrote called The Ritz, and it just lay there. And someone said to me, you know what's wrong? There's 2 things wrong. I said, what? Tell me. They said, there's no setup for the play. and they don't know where they are for 40 minutes. I went in the lobby and wrote a prologue to the play in 10 minutes. It probably took 3 minutes to perform. Made a huge difference. And also someone said, you're also trying to get laughs in front of a Battleship gray set. It's such a depressing color. Warm it up. And the producer spent a lot of money keeping people in the theater overnight, painted the set a very warm red, or not red, the color of Sardis, maroon sort of. The next night, without changing one line, I suddenly turned into Neil Simon, it felt like. The laughs that had never been there were suddenly there, and suddenly the play looked inviting and warm as opposed to this harsh, very, very foreboding. I would never have thought of that. I thought my job was to just write funny lines. It's also someone's job in the theater to have an eye. It says, that color, that big three-story set, Battleship Gray, is oppressive. It does not make you want to be in that room, be in that space with those people. So the theater, you know, as they say in Shakespeare in Love, is somehow it all turns out. Somehow it always doesn't. We try our best to make it turn out.
I talked to Michael Frayn, and he said one of the oddest things about watching Noises Off is that depending upon the direction, it could be the funniest play on the planet with everybody roaring. And he said he's been to some performances where no one laughed at all. Same play.
That's a farce, as The Ritz was a farce, and nothing is harder to get right than a farce. It has to be played with impeccable timing and total seriousness. And once actors smell a laugh, they start doing it to be even funnier if they're funny, and you got to keep saying no. It's because you think you're in the most miserable position in your entire life. That's why the audience is laughing. If they think you're trying to make us laugh, the laughs will go. And oh, I can imagine Noises Off being the last revival on Broadway had a quarter of the laughs of the original. And, you know, people were enjoying it. I was saying, boy, if they'd seen it 20 years ago with Dorothy Loudon and that cast, they would have laughed much louder and much longer, too.
You're listening to an interview with Terrence McNally, whose play, A Man of No Importance, musical, is now at New Conservatory Theater in San Francisco through April 11th. There are certain significant plays in your overall work. One of them is certainly Lisbon Traviata for me, because to me that exposed me to Nathan Lane, right, who was extraordinary in Act 1. I don't believe he may appear for a minute or two in Act 2. I'm not sure.
He's in Act 2 briefly, a little more than a minute, but no, it's a minor, and some people that bothered that they wanted the whole play about him, but it wasn't.
But that play and Masterclass are both about Maria Callas, one secondhand and one firsthand. Mm-hmm. What drew you to her?
Her voice. When I was very young, I heard her voice coming from Mexico City. I grew up in Corpus Christi, Texas, and the Monterey Mexico radio station could be picked up by our FM radio in Corpus Christi, and I was already an opera fan. And one day I just heard this performance of Rigoletto with a soprano called Maria Menighini Callas, they call her, because she sang under the name Maria Menighini Callas in those days, her husband's name. And I just thought her voice was extraordinarily beautiful. Then, like a week later, she was singing Lucia de Lammermoor, and another week she sang Puritani, and I heard two or three broadcasts. And then a year or two later, I saw her name, you know, on these records from Italy, Cetra album. But it was her voice. I had no idea what she looked like. But I really was in on North America on Callas as early as you possibly could be, because she sang in Mexico, I think, before she'd sung in any of the major European theaters, and certainly before Chicago had her. San Francisco never had her here. She was famously fired here. She was at the Met. The interesting thing about her is that no one liked her when she was actually singing opera, but now everyone loves her and she's revered as the greatest soprano of the 20th century, but she was booed at every single performance she gave at the Met.
One of the funniest parts of Lisbon Traviata is the discussion, the war between Tibaldi and Callas. Yeah. And even though Terrence McNally is certainly not the characters, did you participate at all in that war?
Yes, oh, we Callas fans were very, very prescribed in our taste. There was Maria and only Maria. Now, I must say, but what, 40 years later, practically, I can listen to Tibaldi and Sutherland and say, these are pretty good voices here. I still don't respond to their musicianship or the detail they bring to the words, too. Dramatic involvement, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say. But the difference was, Collis fans never went to Tibaldi performances in Booter. We stayed home. Tibaldi fans and Milanov fans came to Collis performances, and they were very hard to get tickets, so you resented them for getting tickets ahead of you, and then they brought radishes and cabbages to throw at her. So they were taking up my seat to boo my soprano, so that made me really angry at them. Now you look back and say, God, in 1 week you could hear Tosca sung by Maria Callas, Renata Tibaldi, and Zinka Milanov. Who wouldn't want those days back?
When you were writing Lisbon Traviata, you were just sitting there going, I got this one, I got this one, I got this one.
Well, that play, you know, the character of Mendy came pretty easily, you know. That play also is, you know, the damage art can play when it becomes a substitute for real life, which I think these people in the play... Maria Callas is finally just a voice, a fantasy, and their own lives are pretty messy. The production we did here in San Francisco was actually superior to the one in New York. Nathan Lane had created the role of Mendy, and we also this time had Richard Thomas in the play, and he was quite extraordinary, and we did it. Marines Theater. It was a wonderful time, the first time I'd ever really spent time in San Francisco. The apartment house was straight up that hill from the theater, and I remember Nathan and I walking up that sometimes, and... Nathan is not a sylph, and I think it was a harder climb on him than me, even though he's younger than me, but we made it up. It was a great time.
Did you expect at that point, did either you or Nathan have any idea about the success that he would have? Was that some kind of weird either fear or fantasy, or did you kind of know that the trajectory was moving that way?
Oh, clearly knew that, yeah. Nathan I saw in the first play he did in New York, and I just thought he was the funniest actor and just a natural stage star. And then when I wrote Lisbon Traviata and he did it, and I mean, we did five or six plays together, and to me he was a star then. He's a bigger star. I mean, you know, he was a star to the New York theater audience when he did Lisbon Traviata or Love, Valor, Compassion. He also did my play Lips Together, Teeth Apart. So he was a theater star, but then Mike Nichols came along and put him in The Birdcage, so that made him a film star, and now there's this phenomena called The Producers. So
why wasn't he in the film of Love, Valor, Compassion? All the rest of the actors were.
Well, we had a falling out over that, honestly. I think the real story was that the people who were producing The Birdcage, it was a huge multi-million-dollar film. Mike Nichols, Robin Williams did not want Nathan to be in a low budget, frankly, gay-themed movie opening before theirs, and I think they talked him out of it. It turned out very well, the movie, and I'm happy with it, but I'm sure I miss Nathan, too. There's very few actors I have not worked with that I, you know, would like give anything to work with. You know, Meryl Streep is probably the only actress I can think of that I'd like to hear her do my words or, you know, be in a rehearsal room with her. And one of those fantasies just came true just a year ago with Angela Lansbury doing a play. It was a short piece. It was 20 minutes, but there was Angela Lansbury on a Broadway stage creating something I'd written. It was pretty exciting.
Terrence McNally, your most controversial work is Corpus Christi. Bears a certain resonance right now, first off because of the Mel Gibson Passion movie, which treats the entire Christ story in a more, let's say, violent way. And the second, of course, is gay marriage. There's a scene in there involving a gay marriage. When you were writing it, did you expect the incredible controversy? Did you think Manhattan Theater Club would even cancel the play? I mean, they were forced to put it back on.
This is a very strange story, Corpus Christi. One, maybe I was naive. I wrote this play thinking, so I've written a play imagining the life of Christ and the apostles as told by gay men and that they were gay. Certainly there have been plays written where Christ is a woman or Christ is a person of color, blah, blah, blah. So I write the play, not expecting a controversy. Then one day I pick up the paper and it says, Terrence McNally's new play has Christ and the apostles nude in most of the play performing lots of onstage sex. Well, that was never true, so the controversy was based on a false apprehension of the play. So I don't know what you know with the controversy. To me, the play is not controversial. Now, a play in which Christ, men having onstage sex will get you closed in San Francisco, even, I would think, even at this theater. You don't have to be Christ. Just two men going at it sexually with erections and all that are going to get you in trouble. So people read a lie about the play. No one ever read the play. That's the trouble with these controversies. People do not read the play. They don't... read the book. They don't see the film. They have opinions. I have opinions about Mel Gibson's movie, why I don't want to see it. It sounds, one, too violent. I hate his homophobia, and I don't want to spend $10 of my money. That'll just read how much money he's going to make from this movie. So, but I haven't seen the film. Well, my opinion is I don't want to see it. That's different than saying he should be killed, as I was, my life was threatened many times, and I still have a fatwa against me, or that a theater should not be allowed to show his movie. That's a big difference, but I choose not to see it. So the quote controversy, if it was really about the play, it would be a very different thing, but no one ever saw the play. They saw an event. I saw it in Chicago, where they're a huge Catholic city. No one started all this nonsense. The play was the first time I really saw the play and enjoyed it as a member of the audience, as opposed to going through metal detectors and crossing picket lines, which I had to do every night in New York. This spring, the play was done in Cincinnati with as much brouhaha as it had seen in New York. There were bomb threats, death threats. You know, the theater had a terrible time. And, you know, a small theater doing these plays, it pushes their resources beyond the breaking point. They just can't deal with all this, you know. We're not a big Hollywood film. You can spin control and manage everything. And it has discouraged a lot of theaters, I think, from doing the play when they read all the brouhaha these little theaters go through. And Manhattan Theater Club is not that small a theater, but they were very badly shaken up by this experience. It's very, very, very hard to put on a new play. You don't need death threats and bomb threats to add to the general merriment. If the apostles were giving one another blowjobs, I think you might say, this is in dubious taste, or I could see a Catholic being upset by this. And this person who started the controversy is a Catholic. His father got Mae West arrested when she did her play Sex. There's a famous picture of Mae West and the cast in jail, taken in 1926 for their play Sex. He called the Archdiocese of New York and asked for a comment about a play in which Christ and the apostles had on stage sex. What is the Catholic Church going to say? Sounds interesting to us. We welcome this new look at Jesus Christ. And of course they were appalled and said, this is terrible and appalling. And suddenly you got a hornet's nest. Everybody's acting like a maniac. And no one's saying, hey, let's read the play. And then, of course, when the play opens, the same asshole who caused me all this trouble, whose grandfather caused Mae West trouble, he writes in his column, well, I've seen the play, and because of my pressures I've put on the play, all the nudity and all the onstage sex has been taken out. And he said, and I have this from an anonymous cast member who spoke, a condition of anonymity, which is something else that's happened in my lifetime. Papers now run anything they want, and they say an anonymous person said. And I grew up when you had to say Bill Smith, give his address practically, said he heard, he saw Monica Lewinsky, you know, on her knees. And now we can just have hearsay, even in the New York Times, and it's appalling.
I mentioned before the death of the show Ragtime on Broadway. It only ran 2 years, did not make 900 performances, but it was still doing 85-90% at the Ford Center. Garth Drabinsky, the entire Live and story came out, and they folded it. Was my understanding that the show probably shouldn't have folded, or was the nut just too high on a weekly basis?
The nut on Ragtime was incredibly high. Once you have things in place on Broadway, which are heavily unionized places, Broadway theaters, it's very hard to scale down. Disney tried it with Beast successfully. They closed down for a while. They moved to a new theater. There's certain effects in Ragtime that cost so much that were not necessary, but Garth wanted. He finally was not a fiscally responsible producer, and I think some of the salaries the cast was earning, in retrospect, were a little high considering who they were at that stage in their careers. But that was Garth, and he was a showman. He created glamour and excitement. But when he got into trouble with what he was doing with the funds, that empire collapsed very quickly. And Ragtime had to sell out every seat at full price. And most shows running on Broadway now in their fifth and sixth years are on heavily discounted tickets. And they've kept their nut way, way down. And the nut on Ragtime was so high. If you started discounting the tickets, then it still would have lost money. It was a grand and glorious trip while it lasted, but Ragtime is being done so much more than I ever thought it would. It's even high school kids are doing it, colleges. I just saw a production of it at NYU by the second year class, drama school, and there was probably 60 of them again singing their hearts out. I think that's going to become a classic. And that's one show I think will probably get a real revival in my lifetime. And there's other ways of doing it. They did it in London. It got great reviews. Heavily scaled down from Broadway, a cast of about 35, and it still had its power, I thought.
It's a gorgeous, gorgeous score. It all works together. It's that opening, wow.
And thanks to Edgar Doctorow, it's a great story and an important story, very moving. And I don't know how you can remain indifferent to the story Ragtime tells, because it really is about how America became America. And I think it exposes all that's wrong in our society, too. Problems we still have to deal with. It's a thoughtful musical. It's very entertaining. It's very powerful and moving, but it leaves you thinking, too.
You're here in San Francisco working on a play that will eventually be produced in 2005, correct?
At this theater. I'm writing it for actors at this theater. It's not titled yet. It's 30 pages or so in the computer, but doesn't have a title yet. But that's quite a bit off, it seems. You know, this September would seem maybe too soon, but September 05 seems awfully far away. But well, it'll be there before you know it.
Terrence McNally, in looking over all of your work, I notice that you never veer completely from the political. There's always an element of that, and I think there must be some underlying feeling about the nature of theater that takes you in that direction.
I think theater, because it's live, it brings people together, and I think when audiences sit in a room and have an experience with actors on a stage, the possibility of transformation, I felt one way going in, I feel this way coming out, is much more possible than it is in almost any other media. And I just think theater has that special power of being in a room together. It's communal. I've only wanted to ever really write about American society. Actually, Men of No Importance, it's probably one of the few pieces I've written that isn't contemporary and takes place in Ireland. But I do think it raises many, many issues that are still with us. But I think all engaged writing is political somehow. I mean, I'm not as overtly a political writer as some of my contemporaries, but you know, it's there. And I mean, no one said it, but when The Ritz was done, an out-and-out sex farce about gay men in a bathhouse, was done on Broadway in the 70s, I thought that was incredibly political. This was years before Boys in the Band, Normal Heart. You know, people were laughing at gay men. They weren't being terrified of them or offended by them. And say they can make as big a fool of themselves trying to get laid as we can. Man of No Importance is about a man coming out in Dublin in the late 50s in a very oppressive, tight, uptight little Catholic parish. So I think my writing has always had an edge, you know. I don't think I'm a polite writer, and I'm pretty confrontational, and audiences get mad at me, too, sometimes. I'm kind of in your face, but I think the theater should be in your face. I don't like polite theater. That's okay.
Making a musical of an overtly political piece like Kiss of the Spider Woman, which is about political prisoners.
And it's about an extremely homophobic man dealing with a outrageously effeminate and equally political gay fellow cellmate, and he's got to make his peace with him, and it's also how he's going to try to manipulate him, and it's a very complex relationship, but he certainly makes a journey in his feeling about gay men in the course of that story, as I think the audience does, too. That someone as seemingly foolish as a Melina in that story can become a man of great importance, and just as this show, what I think is so wonderful about Men of No Importance, someone you'd never look at twice, someone who takes your ticket when you get on a bus in Dublin, suddenly becomes this extraordinarily heroic and important person. And I think theater can celebrate that more than anyone else, you know. It does it better than movies, you know. Erin Brockovich was always Julia Roberts looking gorgeous. I loved it. I'm glad she won her Oscar, but I wasn't convinced that was Julia Roberts fighting the good fight. And I think on the stage here, the character of Alfie Byrne really emerges in all his humanity, warts and all. And I think it's a little more convincing, perhaps, than the kind of attention Julia Roberts brings to the role of Erin Brockovich.
Terrence McNally, here you are working in San Francisco, the home of gay marriages. How do you see that issue playing out on the national scene, or do you think it's almost defanged at this point, where it seems like when we went in, when Gavin Newsom first made the call, a lot of people, except gay people, were up in arms, even on the Democrats, afraid that it would destroy Kerry. And it turns out that more and more Americans are going, hey, fine.
Well, I think you used the right word, defanged. My partner and I, we went to Vermont last year to get married, or we, you know, honored our commitment in a civil ceremony. Marriage, I guess, is not the word, but we have all the rights of a married couple in the state of Vermont. At any rate, we asked people there, how long have you been marrying people? I mean, it's all euphemism, but we got married. We asked people in Vermont, how long have you been marrying people in this state? They said, oh, a year and a half now. And they said, how long was it, did people talk about it? They said, for maybe tops 2 weeks. And there are a lot of people who thought this was the end of the world, the end of Vermont and our way of life. By the end of 2 weeks, no one talked about it anymore. And they said, now the only people who ask us how we feel about gay unions are people like you who come up from New York or another state to get hitched because the wall, you know, the sky did not fall down. Our way of life did not collapse. Our marriage was not undermined. So I think that's what's going to happen. I think Bush really shot himself in the foot with his amendment idea, which I think is going to get major opposition. And I think, you know, they're going to start marrying people in Massachusetts, which is a very sophisticated state. And, you know, that's going to go on for at least 2 years. And by that time, I think this will have spent itself. I think you can no longer demonize gay people. And I think Bush was counting on that. And I think because of so many people have come out over the past 20 or 30 years, because of AIDS, there's a face to gay culture now. And everyone knows gay people. And it doesn't mean they necessarily like them. You know, some of us are sons of bitches, but you know, we're people, and I think everyone gets that now, and you can't say those people anymore. They're people, and they want the same rights I do when it comes to Social Security, benefits, joint income tax. Let them have it, you know. So I think this is something that's unstoppable. And in fact, every day you open the paper, a new state, a new county, a new city is starting this, just shows, and it's a true grassroots movement, which is thrilling.
I interviewed Peter Biskin, who wrote Down and Dirty Pictures about independent film. He also wrote the definitive book about 70s film, and I asked him point blank, would there be a gay major movie star? I expected him to go, no, it's too much, take too much money, it'll, you know, nobody's going to take that chance. He said, absolutely yes, and probably very soon, as this continues.
I think we can have a gay movie star. Will audiences accept a gay man or a lesbian in romantic heterosexual situation? I don't know yet. I don't know. You know, I don't know how I feel. I saw Harvey Fierstein making out with Julia Roberts in a movie. I don't think I'd be too convinced. I don't think he probably wants to. But, you know, we're all human. We go to the movies. There's some suspension of disbelief. But I think what he really means is someone, you know, just as Gary Cooper always played, you know, heroic Westerners. And, you know, there'll be an actor or an actress who play lesbians in all their guises and gay men in all their different manifestations, and we can just have be a gay movie star playing gay roles in a great variety of them, just as you would never limit an actor. But obviously there are roles John Wayne was wrong for. You certainly didn't want to see him doing light comedy, you know, and one of those Doris Day movies that she was doing with the gay Rock Hudson, and he would have been terrible in those. So
Terrence McNally, this brings up a question that I've always wondered about. Now I've finally got you here. What about the idea of colorblind casting?
I'm all for that. Absolutely. Frankie and Johnny has been done a lot with both black, one black, one he's black, she's black. I've had black characters in all of my plays. Audrey McDonald created the role of the nemesis of Maria Callas in Masterclass. And, you know, when I wrote it, I did not write it for Audra as a black role. And I think that'll happen all the time. I've even seen plays where, you know, Gertrude is black and Hamlet is white or vice versa. And you don't go, wait a minute. That's a classic play. I think it could work. And there was talk of James Earl Jones playing Big Daddy in Cat on a Tin Roof. And, some people thought that was terrible. You know, how in a play that is so grounded in the South. And to me, that's a classic play now. A contemporary play, if the curtain went up and James Earl Jones came out as somebody, a white actor's father, I would probably think the play was about about that until I realized it wasn't. You know, until we try it, we're not going to know. Up front, I mean, we certainly had colorblind casting on the Stendhal Syndrome, my most recent play. And, you know, when a play is brand new, you don't know what it's going to be yet. So maybe Frankie and Johnny, what a different play that would have been if Diana Sands, this great black actress who died quite young in her late 30s, I think, had created that role as opposed to Kathy Bates. So I'm all for it. I mean, and I think that its day has come, too. I just, you know, colorblind classing, that implies that theater is going to go on being healthy and young actors and actresses are going to want to work on the stage, and I hope that's true.
You've been listening to an interview with Terrence McNally, whose musical, A Man of No Importance, he wrote the libretto, is at the New Conservatory Theater in San Francisco through April 11th. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.